Hello and welcome back to the IEA podcast. I'm Emily Carver. On today's episode, I talk to Professor Len Shackleton. He's an editorial and research fellow at the IEA. You can also check out the video version over on our YouTube channel. If you enjoy this podcast, please do leave a comment and subscribe. You can also subscribe to our new IEA Daily newsletter by heading over to our website. And to help us keep our content going, why not consider making a contribution? No matter how modest, it would be a huge help to us. You can donate online at iea.org.uk. Coronavirus has dealt a massive blow to the UK labour market. Which sectors have been hit the hardest so far? And is this likely to be only the start of the job losses we're going to see?
The sectors which have been hit most are those which you might expect, those where the public, can meet people for various reasons. And this means that we're looking at hotels, accommodation, bars, restaurants, theatres, cinemas, football matches, all sorts of things like this. And clearly, under current social distancing rules, it's just not possible to run these kind of operations. And what worries me a bit is that I can't see us, in the short term, being able to go back to anything like normal running in these areas. So I think the job losses are going to mount very rapidly once the furlough system runs down.
So thinking about the furlough scheme, the government have begun talking about how they're going to roll it down. How would you advise that the government start doing this?
Well, it's like that old joke of I wouldn't really have started from here, isn't it?
But
there are many problems with schemes of this kind. I think the most fundamental problem really was separating employers from employees by saying you couldn't do any work if you were furloughed. I think the government should have followed the line of the German Kurzarbeit system, which is, as its name suggests, short hours working, short time working, where you could work part of the time and have your wages paid by the government for the rest of the time. So you stay in touch with the employer, and of course you have a much more realistic view about what's actually happening in the labour market. At the moment, people are being furloughed and they have no connection really with their workplace. They got on 80% of normal pay if you're earning average earnings or below, and it's a kind of false security you've got here. We know that a lot of jobs are going to disappear, and I think what we need is a scheme which runs down and makes it realistic to both employers and employees about what is actually happening here. Now, I know the government is planning to change this from August and make employers pay a proportion of the money which people get, but I think that should have come much sooner. And I welcome the fact that from August you're going to be able to work part time, but again, that should have been done much sooner.
Do you think they underestimated the length that the job retention scheme would have to be in place for?
Yeah, I mean, you can't blame the government too much for this. I mean, this is a totally unprecedented situation. Nobody has experienced this before in this kind of form. And, it was easy enough to believe, in March that this would all be over very quickly. It's rather like the First World War being over by Christmas. You know, it's clearly not going to happen. It's going to take a lot longer. And so the cost of this scheme has shot through the roof. The number of people on it, we've now got over a quarter of the workforce on the job retention scheme or the deals for self-employed people and so on. And this is a huge proportion. It was originally anticipated to be much smaller than this, and the costs were manageable. It's clearly not going to be manageable to continue with anything like this scheme indefinitely.
You've argued that extending the furlough serves to delay our readjustment to a changed economy. Some might argue that we're not trying to adjust to a new normal. We're just trying to, weather an unusual period and preserve things as best we can.
That's understandable, but you cannot freeze labour market conditions. And in a normal year, something like 1 million jobs are lost every 6 months. They disappear because businesses close or they downsize or whatever. In normal conditions, of course, at least as many new jobs are created, and so we have either steady or increasing employment. That is not happening at the moment, but the underlying processes that make some jobs no longer viable are going on. Indeed, they're accelerating. So realistically, the sooner businesses realize they've got to get out of this particular area, they've got to repurpose what they're doing, workers have got to look for new jobs and so forth, the sooner we get realism into this situation, the quicker it is that we'll get out of it. We're living in a kind of lotus eaters paradise at the moment, where we think we can just go on in this way. It's a nice summer and all that sort of stuff. But really, we've got a very serious problem in the labour market, and we need to face up to that.
Looking at the gig economy, that's an area that you've written about and researched a lot. How do you think the virus will affect it? Do you think the case for stronger legislation on the gig economy against non-standard type contracts will be strengthened as a result of this? You know, gig economy workers have been in some of the most precarious situations during this crisis.
Yeah, well, the politics of this are one thing, the economics are another. The gig economy is partly a reaction against the sort of employment protection which we have in normal circumstances, where, you know, if you take workers on, it's very difficult to get rid of them, you have to go through all sorts of procedures and so forth. And the fact that, of course, many tasks which employers want done are discrete tasks. They're a piece of work they want doing. It's not, you know, you're not taking on somebody permanently. And much of this, I mean, the gig economy is a sort of cool name for something which has been going on for a very long time. Freelancing, you know, that kind of thing. It's been going on for decades where, a publisher wants to have a book proofread, for example. Rather than employing proofreaders who would sit around most of the time twiddling their thumbs, they send out the book to people who do this kind of work. And in normal conditions, people make quite a reasonable living out of this. Many gigs are just not reducible to a full-time job. I mean, the term gig really comes from, you know, music, you know, bands and things like that. You know, the Rolling Stones or somebody appear in town, and there's a whole load of people who have to be employed to move stuff around, to take tickets, to do all the old stuff. And then the circus leaves town, and those jobs are gone. You need some kind of flexibility that enables jobs to be done when there are jobs there. And I actually think, there's a couple of things. One is that most of these people are self-employed. And one of the things I have a problem with what Rishi Sunak has done is he says, oh yeah, we're trying to help the self-employed at the moment. But as a consequence of this, in future, we're going to charge them higher national insurance and various other things like this. I think we will want to be encouraging self-employment in the future, not discouraging it by taxing it differently and so on. So that I think is a problem.
Yeah, and also looking at past recessions, they can lead to an uptick in entrepreneurship. As people lose their jobs, they try to find different ways of making money. Do you think that this virus will work in that way? Do you think that it might be a catalyst for more entrepreneurs to start businesses?
I think you're right. I think past experience suggests that you know, all problems create new opportunities. You know, this is the optimistic Boris Johnson line, isn't it? But it is true in the economy that you know, every cloud does have a silver lining, and that it creates more opportunities. And you know, I haven't got a crystal ball on this. I'm not putting money into it. But you can see areas where in future people's behaviour is going to change. They're going to live possibly a more home-based life. They're not going to go out to restaurants as much because they're going to be much more expensive because of social distancing and so on. So there are going to be opportunities for furniture manufacturers, for people building extensions to houses, all sorts of things like this. And new opportunities will appear. And what we have to do is to be alert to these opportunities. And what worries me is that, you know, we'll have this tendency to sort of say, well, we've got the government has to control this, and we've got to lay down new rules about this, new rules about that, and so forth. I think we need to relax as many rules as possible. To be fair, the government has recognises to some extent, has made a few marginal adjustments. But I think we need a much bigger programme of trying to deregulate the economy, and particularly in the labour market area, where we've added, in the last 20 years or so, we've added an enormous amount of employment legislation. And taking on workers is very difficult. One of the problems for smaller businesses, for self-employed and so on, is as soon as you take on workers, you incur a whole range of obligations. And it's a difficult, costly thing to do. And I think we ought to make it much easier for people to be taken on. One of the corollaries of that, of course, is if you make it easier for people to be taken on, it probably has to be easier to get rid of them as well, because jobs don't work out, something goes wrong, and you need to be able to take people on without the whole panoply of employment legislation which we have at the moment.
The Trade Union Congress, TUC, recently released a report urging the government to roll out a raft of radical economic reforms to tackle the despair of mass unemployment and aid the UK's coronavirus recovery. Their proposals, as you know, included the creation of a National Recovery Council to oversee economic policy, inspired by Clement Attlee's post-war strategy, increased public spending, an increase in the minimum wage, public sector pay rises, and so on. You responded that this approach, if enacted, would almost guarantee no recovery at all. Could you explain why this strategy would be so disastrous?
Well, I've said before, I don't have a crystal ball, but it does seem to me unlikely that these are the kind of measures which are going to improve job prospects for people. The whole Better Recovery Report really is it's understandable from the union's point of view. They had this line. It's exactly that many of the policies are those which Jeremy Corbyn put before the country in December. How long ago that seems, of course. They were rejected by the public. I mean, things like a £10 an hour minimum wage, for example, that's one thing which you mentioned. Well, that would be considerably above the current national living wage. And moreover, it would be applied to all workers, as I understand this, not just those over 25, which the national living wage does. So, in a trice, you're going to double the cost of employing a 17 or 18-year-old. This is crazy. This is not the way in which to create job opportunities. Another thing they mention is ending 0 hours contracts. Again, straight out of the Corbyn playbook. 0 hours contracts are completely misunderstood, I think, by many of the people who just look at these things in a fairly superficial way. Two-thirds of all 0 hours contracts are part-time workers. You know, not very many people actually depend on 0 hours contracts for their main living. Something like 20% of all 0 hours contract workers are actually full-time students, right? Now, these are people who cannot commit to fixed hours and don't want to commit to fixed hours. There's also a huge chunk of semi-retired people who are in that kind of position, people who are helping out in B&Q on a Saturday or whatever it may be. And, these people neither want nor can commit to a fixed hours contract. So getting rid of 0 hours contract, again, it doesn't help. It just means that some people will no longer have an opportunity to get any kind of work at all. Other stuff, unions being given a bigger role. Yeah, okay. But of course, 1945, in a sense, they deserved this because unions had played a major part in the war effort. And you had Ernie Bevin in the cabinet, of course, there was a sense in which that was carrying forward something which had developed during the war. If we look at the current situation, unions are not pulling their weight in terms of getting us out of this terrible hole we've got ourselves into. The rail unions and the teachers' unions are being extremely recalcitrant at helping to get us back to work. If there was a real effort from the unions to push things forward, that would be one thing. But this is just a list of demands, which we've heard many times before. One of the elements, of course, is a National Recovery Council, which they want to do. Well, I'm a lot older than you, and I've lived through a lot of this stuff. My friend, Martin Ricketts used to work for the NEDA, the National, which was a part of the National Economic Development Council, which was a talking shop of unions, management, and the government, which started off, which ran it through the 60s and 70s until it was finally euthanized by Mrs. Thatcher. Now, this achieved very, very little apart from spending quite a lot of money, having lots of reports, and so on. Beer and sandwiches, all that kind of stuff, talk to the unions, but very little came out of this. And I fear that this National Recovery Council will be something similar.
You've also written about the impact of the lockdown on elder generations. There's been a lot of talk about younger people and how this is going to impact them and their job prospects. What are your concerns with older people?
Well, I'm one myself, of course, so this is something which is very dear to my heart. But no, I think young people are going to suffer the worst. I certainly don't want to downplay that. I'm just mentioning that we shouldn't underestimate the contribution of older workers. And there are about 1.3 million, I think, over 65s who are still economically active. There's nearly 500,000 over 70s who are economically active. Many of these people, of course, will be doing things like running their own businesses, which make a contribution by employing other people as well as the effort of the over 70s. So I think rather than saying, you know, all the over 70s, all the over 65s, or whatever it may be, should just socially isolate more or less indefinitely, never come out of their houses apart from to shuffle in the queue at Tesco's once a week or whatever. They shouldn't forget these are people who have a contribution to make. As I say, not just in terms of the formal economy, but also in running all the fantastic voluntary organisations which this country has in the past been famous for. And, you know, if we suddenly sort of say, no, forget about them, then I think we'll be missing a great deal.
One more thing that you've written a lot about is the high street and the impact that the lockdown measures will have on the landscape. So non-essential shops are now set to reopen on the 15th of June. You argued that some of these businesses simply won't be economically viable, even once they reopen. What policy levers can the government pull to improve conditions for retailers, firstly? Or do you think this will just sort of accelerate the trend already towards online and much of the high street is a lost cause?
I think much of the high street, as we have been used to it over the last 40 or 50 years, I think is doomed. As Steve Davis has said, one of the things that pandemics do is speed up processes which are going on anyway. And it's clear that the high street has been in long-term decline for many years, both a result of things like out-of-town shopping, which was one big problem 20 years ago, but now very much the online shopping, where people can get clothes, books, all the things which were on the high street, delivered to their door within 24 hours or even quicker if they're prepared to pay a premium for it. Those kind of things are going to disappear. Bars, restaurants, things like that, little coffee houses, are just not viable with the kind of social distancing measures which are in place at the moment. There's one around the corner from us, a very, very nice little place. I guess with social distancing, could have four people in it. I mean, you cannot run a business on the basis of that. And so these things are going to go. What we need to do is to make sure that I'm not really in favour of subsidising shops and things like that. What we have to make sure is that these buildings can be repurposed quickly. We need to revisit our planning system, make it very much easier to have change of use of things. New uses will pop up for these things. One very obvious use, of course, for some high street locations is housing. We have a huge housing shortage. To the extent that it will make possible to put more flats, more apartments, etc., on high streets, you know, we need to be able to make these changes pretty quickly rather than have things hanging on for years, boarded up, looking desperate, and really adding to urban blight. So we want to move on from the high street as we have known it in the past to something different.
To finish, one final question. You recently wrote a blog about how we need greater wage flexibility in the public sector, particularly in light of the current pandemic. You argued that, for example, an across-the-board NHS pay increase would fail to differentiate between those who are risking their lives on the front line and those who are sort of doing, I don't know, back-of-house admin jobs, I guess. Why is risk to health a fair way to discriminate in terms of pay? And is this the case in the private sector?
Right. Well, it's not a question of fairness exactly, Emily. The private sector, left to itself, does tend to provide compensation for greater risk. One of the most well-established results in the econometric literature is that, holding other factors constant, those jobs which involve a greater risk of death or injury carry a wage premium. Yeah? And to give an example of something very near to the current situation, in the United States in the early 1990s, when HIV/AIDS was a major problem and a threat to healthcare workers because they didn't know quite how it was transmitted and things like this. In the United States, of course, you don't have an NHS setting national rates for things. What you have is local, state level, or even smaller level health, whether it be private or public healthcare, setting their own wages. And what you found in the United States was very clear that those areas where there's a high risk of HIV/AIDS, nurses were paid more. That's the way the market panned out. If you wanted to get nurses to work in a dangerous environment, you had to pay more. And this shows how markets tend to work. They don't ignore risk, but they let people trade off risk against higher pay. And the fact that they do, of course, it gives rise to the ways in which we value statistical lives. There's been much talk. I think our friend Julian Jessup gave a talk the other day where he talked about valuing a statistical life. This actually depends on the evidence which has been gathered in the United States and elsewhere on the premium which are paid for higher risk to life. And the idea is that if people take on these risks to get this higher pay, this represents an implicit valuation of their lives, you know, how much risk you're prepared to take. So this is a well-established principle. To come back to the question which you asked, what I'm saying is that many of our healthcare workers are taking very serious risks, and it's arguable that we should be paying them more to take these risks on. What we should not be paying is an across-the-board payment to, you know, everybody, back-of-house people, administrators, people administering healthcare trusts, and all these people on very nice salaries already, very little risk to their jobs and very little risk to their person. Why should we just whack out more public money in a situation where we're already spending hand over fist and you know, as if money is free thing?
Yeah, I wonder if there would be the political will to differentiate in that way.
I don't see why not, because it's fairly obvious who are the frontline workers. Those, you know, they are primarily people with medical training. There's a lot of people in the health service who don't have medical training, but are nevertheless working for it. I should think it's fairly easy to do that.
Sounds sensible to me.
Yeah, but as you say, it's the politics of this. And it's very easy. You see, this is go back to what we were talking about, the Better Recovery Programme from the TUC. A lot of these things sound wonderful in a world where everything's free and, you know, certainly let's pay public sector workers more, let's pay everybody more, but we can't do this. We have to set priorities. And a priority at the moment is not increasing across the board public sector pay.
Lastly, before we finish, we've seen a lot of talk about the government bailing out car firms. What do you make of that?
This is where I feel ancient, because I've been through this kind of thing before. We've had bailing out car companies and indeed a whole range of industries throughout the 60s and the 70s, not much good ever comes of it, really. If the British public want cars, it will be in somebody's interest to make them in this country. It may not be existing producers. It may be that they will sell out and to somebody else, and new businesses will start and so forth. Many of these companies are, of course, not British owned in the first place. Why we should be wanting to pump a lot of money into this area, I don't really understand.
If you enjoyed this, please do subscribe. Check out our newsletter, which you can sign up to on our website. And to help us keep going, a contribution, however modest, would be much appreciated. Thank you.